Civilization, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
3 days, Will is going to start being Glastonbury. There's a leaflet for the next event coming up. Tickets will be on sale in January. This year we had Dr. Ian Rippenstein. And it was really barnstorming, and I think what you're going to get tonight is going to be equally valuable. Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier on, one of the problems we have is you get the divide, you get the alternative world, the academic world, the scientific world, the wacky world. And it's so important to have people to bridge that divide. And maybe, completely unintentionally, Ian has bridged that divide, or found it bridging itself in his life. And to hear the story of how this happened, and to hear somebody openly finding a way to balance this, it is really encouraging and fantastic. So we've invited him here tonight, and we're really glad that you're here, Ian. And I'm going to hand you over. So a big hand, please, for Ian Rippenstein.
Water in the night, danger. Kept watching that danger. After all, we got bored. What is nothing. So we cleared the travelling subway. I said, I'll go and make some coffee. Now, it had been raining that evening. It was a warm summer evening, it was quite hot at night. The rain was pelting us. We closed the window. And I went out into the kitchen and looked up at the goldfish bowl light in the kitchen. Blimey, it was half full of water. And what happened was, it was an old Victorian house. The bathroom was above the kitchen. The bathroom window had been left open. The rain had blown in, hit the wall, ran down the wall, gone through the floor, into the wiring, and as water does, it found its way through the wiring and filled up the goldfish bowl. Now, no one put the goldfish bowl right. No one had left the room. And besides, we weren't stupid kids. If anybody had known that, they'd have called the alert. So, we actually got a true message through the Ouija board. That was pretty good. I mean, we're all shocked. But if the CIA were to say, Ian, we're going to wipe your brain with all the psychic stuff happened to you, but give you one thing you're allowed to remember, what would that be? It would be this one. This is not my friend Felicity. I nicked her off the internet. But my friend Felicity looked like this. When we were 19, it was like my first year at medical school. And the first and only long vacation we had, I was at my friend Nick's house. So I did medicine at Nottingham. My friend Nick did physics at Leicester. So we used to see each other quite a lot. And he had a girlfriend called Felicity. And she'd come down to stay with me in the summer holidays. And my sister was with me. So there were three of us aged 19, Nick, Felicity and myself, and my sister aged 15. And we were all very adolescent because although Felicity was going out with Nick, she had a crush on me, and my sister had a crush on me. So there's all this adolescent emotion going on. And that's important. I make a note of that because we're having a perfectly ordinary conversation with all these energetic undercurrents going. And all of a sudden, I was looking at for Felicity, and I saw this. It was not quite what I saw. Actually, I saw a blonde-haired snow queen. Again, I linked this off the internet. I'm just trying to give you an impression of what I saw. So I was speaking to this perfectly ordinary dark-haired woman, and all of a sudden, I saw a blonde-haired snow queen with blue eyes. Now, the most intriguing thing was that this figure hadn't fully formed. It had, like, very thick, distorted white lips covered with frosted lipstick, high cheekbones, blonde hair with a fringe, and piercing blue eyes. I mean, these aren't blue eyes, but the figure I saw had piercing blue eyes. Now, in summer 74, there was a being used term download, but I got a download, a telepathic download, and it was this: stop, keep back, what we're doing is wrong. And you're back there, I'm just draining their energy and emotions. And it wasn't unkind, it was like a physical force with it. And the other message was, mark this, know there's more to life than meets the eye, and one day you will understand. And at the precise instant, my sister, who was 15, and she saw our profiles, stood up, the top of her voice, started screaming, the top of her voice, my God, can you see those lips? She was terrified. I turned around to my sister and said, you've seen it too, and looked back, and this seems completely normal. What do you do with that? I mean, we've both seen it. It was unbelievable. I mean, didn't know what to do. So, with the help of the Scooby-Doo class, I'll tell you what happened. So, we jumped from Nick's house into the car. We drove in my dad's car to my parents' house. We woke them up, and you can imagine what they said. We were morning, well, yes, please. So they take Nick and Felicity back home, and so we did. So the next day, obviously, I decided I was going to phone my friends. And my friend Steve, this is Steve's house in Tottenham, he said, well, I don't know what this is, but I have a neighbour who's a medium. And he lives next door to me. His name's Keith Hudson. Why don't we tell him? So we told Keith Hudson, and Keith Hudson came along. Now Keith was a bit older than us. He was 27, tall, balding, gambling, strange looking guy. And he said, oh, well, what you saw was a thing called transfiguration. What's that, Keith Hudson? He said, well, it was a spirit guide. Spirit guide, yeah, they're falling in front of her to protect her, presumably from my, you know, I was draining her energy. And I thought, well, no, by that, it has to be a hallucination. On the other hand, my sister saw it. I said, no, this is not meant to be real. Oh, you know, I'm in this real bind. Remember, first year of medical school, this was 1974. They'd only just finished landing on the moon. Well, theoretically, yeah. And I was into science. I mean, there was nothing I could do with that. So, what do you do with that? Well, you put it to one side, and you hire them off, and you just get on with it. So I got on with it. And nothing happened between 1974 and 2003. Well, I mean, why happened? Met my wife, got married, had babies, the normal stuff. Kids grew up, and life went on. And eventually, I got older, as you can see here. I don't really recognise that guy there. So, when he came, we called my patient me a pillar to the community. And that was it, really. Yeah, so there I was, one day in surgery, July the 4th, 2003, 11:58. That's when I went into the twilight zone. And I know this because I have a record on my computer. This was the appointment for Keith Bishop. Let me talk about Keith Bishop. Every doctor should have a patient like Keith. And if you have a patient like Keith, you either run up and hug him or run away, because Keith will turn your life upside down. This guy turned my life upside down. So let me talk about Keith. Keith, when I first met him, I was 29, he was 24. His father upholstered the mastermind chair. He came from working class stock East End, and his dad got him a job at the BBC. He was in security. He was a boxer, so he got a security job. And he's a lovely guy. He used to do favours for all the VIPs that come along. If you're a security guy at the BBC, you have to be vetted by MI5. He met a lot of very famous people. He did them favours. And eventually, and I used to see Keith, because he felt like a fish out of water. And I did too. I'm from a working class background, so we're quite similar. We both felt that we were in fields, above our station, you might say. So I used to spend a lot of time speaking to him at the end of surgeries, counselling him. Eventually, he left the BBC, and he set up a PR firm called Media Celebrity Services. Sort of B-grade list people, really. Harry Hill, a few HP Sunderlands. He did all right. Max Clifford used to send him tickets, used to be grasshopper, like he was like his underling. Now Max Clifford's in prison. He's doing very well. He never liked him. So, it was 11:50 at the end of surgery, and I don't hang around. I like to go swimming, because I go and do my business, but I always go for a swim at lunchtime, and it's a liquid lunch for me. Then I go back into my afternoon surgery. So I don't like to hang around. And Keith was like, Keith's not very good timekeeper. So I was sat behind my desk, and I thought, well, Keith, Blake, he's not going to turn up. I tried to get up. Someone made me sit down. This is strange. I tried to get up again. Someone made me sit down. Then the phone rang. And it was Keith's agent. And he said, Mr. Bishop's at Southbury Road Station. She's fighting acute surgery. She might hang around. So I said, yeah, I'm not going to hang around too long. So Keith came in, out of breath, and panting. And then he has his blood pressure. And he always tells good stories. So I let him sort of calm down, because they've got to take some blood pressure from him in Russia. And he always tells the celebrity gossip. And as he's talking, he suddenly looks at me. He says, I've got this man here, Doc. He tells me, he says, he knows you. He's the grandfather you never met. He must have told you something. And this is odd because I've been thinking about my grandfather a lot. I never met him. This is my grandfather on Brighton Beach in 1919. He was, my mum was one of five children. And it was a bit of a fractious, disputatious Jewish family. And people always call me out with everybody else. And I had actually fallen out with my parents. Quite badly. We got being rejected from the family. I was feeling very miserable. And I realised that, and I've interviewed my cousins and my uncles, and I realised that actually the problem being this guy, he'd actually done very well. He's a baker in the East End. But unfortunately, he's very fond of gambling. So what he'd do is he'd take the money out of the till and ride on horses. So my grandma, again, who I never met, had quite a bad life. And I realised the problem that was going with my family was probably down to him. But I needed sort of counselling and family therapy. So I've been thinking about my grandfather and what he might have met him. And so I was intrigued enough to let Keith carry on, because there's no way Keith would know that I'd be thinking about this guy. So he said, no, this is how it works, Doc. He's going to speak through me. It's not going to be quite through me. He's going to tell me what to say, and he's going to tell me what to say, and I'll say it, but anything he says will be him, not me. And I said, Keith, how come you tell me you listen to spirits? He said, yeah. I said, no, you've been 19 years, how come you haven't told me? He said, well, that's not the sort of thing you tell your dog, you think you're mad. I'm thinking, yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking I've got deception, this guy. And that's yeah, that's very difficult. That takes 3 hours, social workers, not going to get my swim here, okay? It's a pain in the ass. Anyway, so he started to talk. 20 minutes later, my jaw was on the floor. He told me everything that was going on. It was stunning. And he sort of shifted gear and he came around and said, was that all right, Doc? I said, Keith, that's marvellous. How do you know that? He said, it's not me. He said, William tells me you should be doing this. I said, who's William? Oh, he used to be my boss at the BBC. Well, he got it, came my spirit guide. I'm thinking, woo, yeah, really? Why not, you know? That William says, you're like a man on the edge of a cliff. He says, don't be afraid, you should be listening to spirit. You should be doing this. Don't be afraid to take a leap of faith off this cliff. They'll catch you. Who? Spirits. Really? They left my room. Interesting. If we look at the man on the edge of the cliff, who's familiar with the major arcana of the tarot? Yeah. If we look at the fool, the fool is the man on the edge of the cliff. And if we look at the esoteric significance of the fool, it's the spirit of such experience that starts the spiritual journey. So I started my spiritual journey. I didn't know it. The question is, was I a wise fool or was it a fool's errand? Well, we'll find out. Things happen fairly quickly after that. So everybody likes to tell me their dreams. I'm going to tell you my dream. So it started with a really weird dream, very intense. I found myself in my dream sitting at my auntie Lily's table. My auntie Lily used to have lovely dinner parties. And in my dream, I was at auntie Lily's big white tablecloth, and I was opposite my cousin Carol, who's a psychotherapist, the Jungian psychotherapist, very significant in York. And she was trying in the dream to get me to do a chest x-ray on her patients. In the dream, I was trying to say, no, Carol, I can't do a chest x-ray on your patients, on my patients. And then I thought of something, I heard myself saying, and then besides, I'm not psychic, I can't see auras. And then all of a sudden, to my left, in my dream, I heard a popping voice say, of course you are, boss. I look around, there's a little short, stop Indian guy, not really Indian, but an Indian from India, chubby guy, with a flat cap that you see sort of in Yorkshire with a whip there. And above him was a warlight. He said, I'll show you. But with that, he turned and flipped the warlight on. And these amazing blue lights, like gem-like shafts of blue light came out. And he said, what do you do with all that blue? And in my dream, I said, as if I already always know, I give it to people. And I woke up crying. And I woke up my phone. I said, I think I'm going mad. And she said, you've always been a bit crazy, but don't worry, I still got it. So I was on my own. The next thing that happened was, this was, the GCSE results are on the, I think, the third Thursday in August, aren't they? Yeah, so this was the third Thursday in August, soon after that. So it was my son's GCSE results, and the idea was that I had taken the afternoon off, I was going to go home, and I was going to be at home for Josh to get his GCSE results. So, we have to do home visits. I thought, I'd go into the surgery, look at the visit book, take the visit before surgery so I can get my phone so that I can swim and see what Josh got. Took the one visit in the book and it was within walking distance. So I threw my car keys on the desk and as I was walking in my car, and as I left my room, I felt a blow to the back of my head and I heard a voice saying, pick up your car keys or they get stolen. And I thought, nonsense, I was in a rush to just walk out. In my rush, I went to the wrong house, eventually got to the right house, and got back to the surgery with seconds to spare for my surgery to start, and only to find my reception there and say, Ian, you got blue Corsa? I said, yeah, I should. Well, we just chased two boys out there. We think they've run off the property key. And I said, I knew that was going to happen. So she said, well, why didn't you give your car keys then? I said, no. So what happened was, someone had gone into my surgery, thank God they just lifted the car key and left the surgery keys. They got into the car park, pressed the remote, seeing which lights flash. Got into the car, but thank God, it was an automatic, and they got stymied by the automatic. Meanwhile, lady across the road from the flat saw what was going on, phoned the practice manager, she chased them off. But they run off with my car with the car keys, and I had drugs in the car, so we didn't know what had been stolen. So what did you do? Well, I phoned my wife and she walked to the AK, got in and they hit my phone. Luckily, I hadn't taken prescription pad of the drugs. But I had to phone my insurance company to get the logs changed. In order to do that, you have to have a crime reference number. You get a crime reference number by telling the police. So, I phoned the police station, which is just a crossroad. This is one of the 10 police stations. They've brought it down now. You can't actually go to the police station unless it's some sort of training mistake. But this was when the police station was there, just across the road. Not a very nice place. I tried to phone, no answer. And in my police station, she said, lucky no one's been shot then. She had a little time with the police. So in the end, I was actually really upset. You know, I actually left my waiting room, left the patient. I'm sorry, I've got to go to the police station. Go across to the police station. And the last time I'd been there, it'd be a very nasty place. A lot of tall men with sort of truncheons and things. Go there, and it's completely transformed. The doors open. On the wall were drawings, like spirit drawings, of Christmas and little Buddhas and Sikh and the Om symbol. And there were three little Buddhas on the counter. It's very odd. And there was a guy in front of the counter, just on my patients. Big bruiser. So I thought, there's a kid behind him. He turned around and saw me. He said, oh, hello, Doc. What do you think these bruises? Stripped off. So I showed him all these bruises in a fight. I wanted to look at his bruiser. I was thinking, oh, okay, fine. Let's get my friend reference on that. He moved on. It was my turn. And set back for the counter was a desk. There was a guy in a Metropolitan Police civilian uniform and a secretary. And they were looking at the computer. And time was going. I was thinking, I've got to get back to my surgery. And I really looked at him and he looked at me and said, sorry, sir, the computer's very slow. He looked at me and he looked at me. I thought I was slowing down. Eventually, he said, I've got it running. What's your date of birth? I gave him my date of birth. And he said, oh, you're a Leo like me. And I said, are you into this new age stuff? He said, yeah. He said, actually, I'm doing a degree in spirituality. I'm a psychiatric nurse at Chase Farm Hospital. I'm just here temporarily. And I said, oh, well, you're interested? No. I knew my car was going to get stolen. I heard a voice. He said, we were meant to meet. And with that, he took me out of his drawer some Native American cards. He said, I'll give you a reading. I'm in a research station. He wants to give you a reading. So he goes, now at the time I've been writing this software project for 9 years. I was with the next Bill Gates. Yeah. So he said, look, think of a question. And the cards will answer himself. Okay, so I said, will my software be successful? And took the card, he looked at the little book and said, the world is not yet ready. Too right. Can I have my primary reference number now? Just like this up, yes. I walked back, and I left the police station. I thought, if I go back in there, I don't need to be there. I think I was in an alternative universe. So I go back to the surgery, and I start telling this story to the receptionist. They all start going, you're in the twilight zone. I certainly was. That weekend, we had a family party in Surrey, St. Kent. And it was a lovely house. Loads of second and third cars, the only one. No. First person I met was a woman who was an occupational therapist. And she started to me about the fact that she grew up in a haunted house with a poltergeist. And I was getting very spooked by them. I was getting running into this stuff. So I said to my wife, if you speak to her, and I can't deal with this anymore. So I go into the kitchen, get a glass of wine, and go into the living room. It's a lovely house. As I go into the living room, there's a swing bench. My cousin Rose is on it, sitting next to this rather podgy man. And as I walked into the garden, she said, I could hear her speaking to him. She said, I used to be a spiritual leader until the kids were born, and I had to give it up. So I said to Rose, what's happening? I keep on bumping into this. She said, well, they obviously want to work with you. I said, perfect. She said, the spirits. Spirits? She said, yeah. What do you mean? She said, well, there may be doctors and nurses, and when they die, they go to the other side, and they want to carry on working. Maybe they've chosen me. And I said, yeah, right. Things like this happen all the time. Too few to mention. And I started telling my patients, well, actually, because I've known my patients for a long time, this is Dave Godfrey. Let me tell you about Dave. He's a scientist. Well, he was a scientist. He had a degree in biochemistry. Dave's a shamanic healer. Dave studies time in the sweat lodge. He thanks to him the sun rises every year. He beats the drums at the winter solstice at Stonehenge. He's a lovely guy. And he's a very sensible guy. And I started saying, you know, what's this about, Dave? And he said, well, you know, you obviously have to get hold on this here, because if you don't, he'll drive you mad. He said, join a circle. I said, what are those? Well, they're a spiritualist church. He said, well, you know what I mean, a spiritualist church? My wife's Hindu. I'm a non-practicing Jew. We don't even have to attend the Lord in church. He said, well, Spirit wants to work with you, he'll be shown the way. The next day, my wife's looking at the Enfield Independent, a local paper, and she happened to notice a little box advert from Beacon Light Spiritualist Church. In Hudson, the guy who I met 30 years before when Felicity's face had changed, my wife had never met him but heard the story endlessly, she said, oh, Keith Hudson's giving a demonstration of clairvoyance at the local Spiritualist Church. Why don't you go? I said, I'm not going. She said, well, we ought to go. I said, not bad. She said, well, we ought to go. I said, not bad. She said, we must go. I said, all right. Okay, okay. So we went. Dragging along. So I sat at the back. And I look back at the window. I remember the pictures of me when I was young. In the dark, I actually had a beard on Keith. I mean, there's no way you'd take me for the same person, would you? When I met Keith, the very first time I was 19, he looked at me and said, you've got a lot of knowledge around me, and you don't know you know, but we're one. I said, well, that's easy, I'm better to you, you can say that. So we're in the Spiritualist Church, and I'm right at the back, and he's giving everybody messages. He says, sir, to me, you have lots of knowledge around you, you don't know that you know, but you will one day very soon, and they told me you actually write a book about it. I thought, I bet he says that to everybody, actually he doesn't. And at the end of the service, the president of the church said, well, Keith Hudson hasn't got a card, he won't even lift home. I said, yeah. I'll give him a lift, but only if he comes back to my house for a cup of tea first. And I ran out to sit just to, you know, to say hello to Keith, because he didn't recognise me, he went back at it, because he didn't get some hot people. He said, Keith, is he here? He said, yeah, he's the doctor. He said, yeah, I said, I was talking about you the other day. So he came back to my house, and we caught up together, and I took him back to August over in this, and he said, look, I serve Vestry Road Spiritualist Church. And he said, I run the largest open circle in North London where we do psychic awareness and training meetings. You don't have to be a spiritualist. I said, how long do you try? And as it was Keith, I thought, what I've got to do. So in February 2004, I started training as a medium. So let me tell you how I train as a medium. Anybody here sat in a circle? Few of you. So, yeah, okay, well, I'm preaching, literally preaching to converts, I suppose. But for those of you who haven't, let me just run you through what circle. So, we'll have open prayer, where we open up the spirit, we then do guided meditation, we give messages, and we close down. I'll talk you through this. So, opening prayers are like grace before meals. And the process of opening up uses the Ayurvedic context of the chakra system. So, the idea is that we all have these psychic centers, seven of them, seven major ones, which are along the spine. And the idea is you draw a light up, you make contact with the earth. This is all using your imagination. You imagine the light coming up from the earth. As it comes up, it opens up each chakra, which each has a different color, the colors of the rainbow in turn. As it rises up, you finally open your crown chakra, you imagine light going up to heaven, and then light coming down from heaven. This is a way of connecting it to receive inspiration from the spirit of God. And then, after we open up, we do a guided meditation. Now, there are many ways of doing meditating. I mean, there's Zen meditation, and there's headspace meditation, but the meditation that spiritualists use when training mediums is called going on a journey. So the idea is if you're training your imagination. So now, we used to imagine, we're calling our imagination as just nonsense. It's just fantasy, it means nothing. But spiritualists use imagination as an energy, as an organ. It's an organ to receive inspiration from spirit. So we're using images, our imagination. And we stimulate this by imagining we're going on a journey. So people would imagine that we're going off through natural landscapes, very fond of medieval banquets and medieval jousts and fairs. And then you suddenly throw in, what's the colour of the jerkin that person's wearing? He catches. You have to be looking at the scene. Beautiful landscapes. And after we've gone on the journey, we would then go to what I consider what we ought to be thinking. giving messages from spirit, from the spirit. So how does one do that? And it's very difficult. I found it's really difficult. It's less difficult now. As a doctor, you don't say the first thing that comes into your head. Anybody who's in a scientific or professional discipline, you watch what you say, you think before you speak. That's not what you do with leadership. You have to hook on to that first pleasing thought, be aware of it, and you have to, it's a bit like angling. You hook your fish and let it run, see where it runs to, and you pay attention to it. But you don't try and analyse it. You will analyse it in the end, but you have to catch those fleeting thoughts you normally dismiss. And then you must not be afraid to give it out. Now that means, don't be afraid to make a fool of yourself. You may say something that sounds foolish to you, but it's actually meaningful to somebody else. So you've got the image, you've got some ideas in your head. The question is, who are they for? It's called map reading. How do you know who to give the message to? Now this is very fortuitous. At the time, Heath was using the number technique. This had been developed by a medium called Michael Raven. And it's actually effectively a single blind trial. Let me explain what happens. So the idea is you wouldn't give a message to a person, you give a message to a number. Now Heath said, so Keith would look at the circle and he'd start saying, you're number one, but he wouldn't tell you you're number one. He'd either go clockwise or clockwise and do what you should ask the person. And there's 26 people in the circle, and sometimes we have 26 people. He'd pick someone to be number one, and either go clockwise or anti-clockwise, and everyone had a number. But he wouldn't tell you when he started, he wouldn't tell you the number one until the end. And the idea would be that you had to give a message to a number. At the end, he'd crack the code and tell you who the message was for. So that was quite scientific. I could buy that. Because, you know, you don't know who you're being messaged to, and they eventually take it. And that's pretty good. The question is, how would you know who to give a message to? So I had a few techniques. The first technique I used was imagining that I was watching a film. You know, the old-fashioned films, you have a countdown. And the very first one I did is number four. I saw this chap. And the message was for number four. It was, tell them to check the holiday arrangements. So at the end of this, so what happened was, I had these images in my mind, everybody else would have images in their mind, the numbers, and we'd be in the dark, and Keith would have Harry Potter, he made his pen, straight out of the screen, and he'd say, Keith, message for number four, and say, what is that? And he's like, check the holiday arrangements, you like the market, what, Keith, message number six, and he'd be writing it down. And at the end, he'd say, well, your number, they go through the messages. When he cracked the code, number four turned out to be Jenny, and I just described the man. She said, well, that's my Uncle George, he always comes through. But I don't know what the holiday arrangements are. So I thought that wasn't very good. The next week, when she came back, she realised, this was the early days of the internet booking holidays, she booked a holiday on the internet, but hadn't paid it correctly. So, in fact, she would have missed the holiday had she not checked. So that was pretty good, I was pleased with her. But I still didn't know how I'd done it. Pretty soon, that got a bit boring, so I tried another one. Imagine a whiteboard, sort of presentation given medical talks, and I imagine there'd be a number in the top left-hand corner, and I try and imagine if there's something drawn on the whiteboard. And one day I saw something like, it's a joke cartoon of a miner. In fact, the miner was pointed to the holes in the ground, and that was for number, I think, number 11. When the code was cracked, Joe was number 11, and he said, oh, that's good, Doc, my patio's just fallen in there, and a big hole in there. That's pretty good. How's that happen? That's not going to happen. So I think it's getting intrigued. It got me because there's obviously more going on than just people putting stuff out of thin air and guessing. I mean, I felt I was guessing, but I was getting results. Then one of them did direct measurements. So a woman had come in who, the first time, named Joan, and she was sitting in a circle, and Mary next to me had seen, said to Joan, I can see a light behind you. Funny enough, I'd seen this behind her as well. Again, it's sort of off in my mind, it had a light behind her. So I said, I've seen that too. She said, well, give it up. So again, I said, oh, I can see some light behind you. As I said, it's right up. So Keith said, well, go and ask them. Ask the guides, ask for information. And at the end of the circle, I went up to her and said, you know, I've got more information. I've got this waterfall, and I could see this woman standing in the waterfall, and she looked like my fellow. She's very similar to you, but she was a lot calmer. And I think you looked after her when she died. And I said, can you tell me? She said, yes, she's my twin sister. She looked like me. And she was a lot calmer than me. I said, what's the waterfall? She said, well, before she died, we took her to Aysgar Falls in Wiltshire. It's her favourite place. And she took a lot of comfort for that. In fact, she said, well, thank you. And she didn't turn up again. She got the message. That was very helpful. So I began to realise that this could be quite therapeutic. Anyway, when after getting messages, we then do a closing down, the closing down prayer, just to close the chapters and do verse, and then ask for some protection. That's fine. Anybody know who this is? Yeah, okay, well, when you start studying the scriptures, inevitably you deal with guys. This is a big problem for me. This is Cyril Birch. Cyril Birch, very famous guy. He was a spirit guide of Maurice Barbanel, who was the former editor of Sight and Hearing. I had a real problem with guys. Look, between you and me, I mean, I could cope with the idea of people coming to me just about. As long as you didn't do my work. But scary guys, looking over your shoulder, can I see you when you go to the toilet? This is a bit weird. For some reason, he didn't sit up for any of them. Really? Really? So what if they were doing meditation? The spirit is always demanding. They have to prove your guys are real. So, apparently we all have a mark. Did you know that? No, the spirit can be very dogmatic. We had a medium, another Keith, not what Keith has, said, we've all got a mark. One of the women said, oh, I've got a nun, Keith. Well, you can't have a nun. He said, nun. Oh, well, Keith, I've got a nun. No, I'm not having it. But apparently you've got a monk, right? Yeah? This is my monk, better than your monk. Mine's a little blessing better. My monk's a nestle. Funny enough, I've met my monk before we've been talking about the monk. We've done a visualization, and I found myself on a journey sitting on a white bench outside a white monastery in a hot climate, opposite this guy, who looked like the Reverend Lionel Fanthorpe. You know that guy, you know, from 14 to 15? And I said, who are you? He said, I'm a spirit guide, Nestor. Nestor. I said, why are you Nestor? He said, well, I was a Nestorian monk. And you were, so he said, I was the abbot of the monastery, and you were the administrator of the monastery. You were a fussy little monk. We called you little brother. He said, you were a fussy little monk. You were the administrator. And the reason why you've come being reincarnated in this life is because of all the office equipment you've got in the 20th and 21st century. And I'm thinking, really? And I've always had a fascination for this equipment. I mean, I really thought, is this a reason for coming back to this Vale of Sorrows just to use your office equipment? He said, yeah, you'd be the cure for the office equipment in the 9th century. Yeah, you'd love it. So, I've already met Nestor. And this is a Nestorian monastery. Nestorianism has died out. But it was around Syria. He claims that he was here in 9th century Syria. Go figure. I don't know. So, here's the proof. So, here's the question for him. What has a 9th century Nestorian monk got to do with my old secondary school at the time, my old library, and Boots in Enfield? Any idea? You don't know. Okay, well, why not? Oh, actually, I'll tell you. There's a story. This is how Nestor proved that there's something odd going on, even if he's not as real as your name. So, this is my school in Tottenham. It's a very rough area. I was the last of the Bramwell. Became a secondary, a comprehensive school in a sinking state. The year I went to medical school, the teacher got a knife. So, even when I was secondary school, in order to get out of being beaten up in the playground, I became a librarian. So, I could do all my homework and get all books. I was very sort of studious kid. And one of the prefects there was called Lyndon Lewington. He was like basically a larger, fatter, older version of me. He was a sixth former. And he used to be very excited to twist my ear and call me a dear child. He had a big impression on me. And he left when I went into the second form. And when I was a sixth former, I got a Saturday job at Muswell Library. And I was looking at medical school places. And I shows at Manchester and the Welsh National School of Medicine. And for one day, I was transferred to a green library. And on that one day, Lyndon was doing a placement there as a librarian. And he'd just come down from doing a neurosciences degree. And he was asking me, what do you want to do at university? So I said, well, I want to do medicine. He said, have you looked at Nottingham? And I had looked at Nottingham, but I hadn't been impressed with the prospectus of new medical school, and I discarded it. And he actually drove me home in his car. And I remember him very clearly, as I got out of the car, he leaned over to Ian, make sure you look at the Nottingham prospectus, you should go there. And I looked at it, and actually I went there, because he was right, to the prospectus. So, and I met my wife there. So he actually changed my life. So, in the 90s, I was at another local library, Bushill Park Library, getting some books with my wife and my two little boys there. And there was this rather portly, grey-haired gentleman there, with a young wife and two little boys. And I said to my wife, that's Lyndon. She said, Lyndon? She said, he's the guy who brought us the galaxy. You don't know, but he may tell tales about him. So I'm going to go up to him and say, and introduce myself. So I went up to Lyndon in the library and said, you're Lyndon. He was like, I said, I'm in Lundestein. You just dismissed my ear and called me dear child. You told me to go to Nottingham. So I did. I'm now a doctor. These are all my little children. Thank you, Lyndon. And he went white. So he said, my God, Ian. He said, because after I told you to go to medical school, I went to medical school. I'm now a consultant at Hammersmith in cardiology. And this is my wife and children. And it turns out his wife was the health centre I wrote for my wife. And we just looked at each other. And the librarian said, I know that you have in my life. Did you stop it? It's a library. Why am I telling you this? Okay. So, I can buy a pair of sunglasses for minutes in Enfield Town. And I'm choosing a book in the library. Do you get a thing? Library, library, library. And all of a sudden, I hear my guy, Nestor, in my head. I'm hearing voices in my head. I'm a doctor, I'm hearing voices in my head, saying, put the books down with them and go into minutes and get the sunglasses you want. I said, you're not real. Trust me, go with it. All right, put the books down, I go to this, get the sunglasses, and I go to Boots in Enfield. And I said, what do I do now? And there in front of me, Lyndon and his wife Kay, looking at me. And I said, Lyndon, Ian, Lyndon, what are you doing here? He said, I'm buying stuff for Boots. What are you doing here? I said, my spirit guide has come here, and just to prove that he's real. And Lyndon looked at Kay, and Kay looked at Lyndon, and Kay said, Lyndon, I realised it's getting a bit sore. I said, nice to meet you, Lyndon. I turned my head and went out. That's how Nestor proved that he was real. It was really competitive, this is a guess, I know. I have another guy. Who's this guy? Derek McCormick. Yes, most haunted. Actually, Keith Bishop knows Derek, and he's a bit histrionic, I think. He's very, very psychic. He's actually very good. He hands up, doesn't he? Anyway, do anybody know Derek Nicholas guy? Sam? I must have thought I had there. I fancy one there. Because I'm in my surgery one day. And I have this guy. Sense this guy behind me, tall African, sort of Oriental person. So I said, well, who are you? And he said, I'm Kosa. So I'm in front of my computer, so I can Kosa. I get KOSA, I get XHOSA. They've heard the COSA tribe. It's about COSA. So after she lives in Tutu, Nelson Mandela, then we call them COSA. It's actually a COSA. It's actually this click tone. Is that in trouble in your case? Just call me COSA. So this is a 19th century COSA warrior from South Africa. He actually said that we were on a boat together. A ship off the East Cape in a previous life. Anyway, he shows me these around his ankle. It's very significant for me. So, he said, I'm your clairvoyant guide. So, Cousin's job is to bring in the spirits and help me. And again, I don't know what to make of this. So, one day, I'm in circle. I've had a long time. My father-in-law just died. I've had a long time of work. I was absolutely knackered. I remember saying to him, I actually said, I'm not going to do this anymore. If you're real cozy, you do this. I just let, for the first time in my life, I just let go. And with that, I saw this double silhouette come into the circle. And it resolved into two little people, man and woman. And in my head, the man says that his name is Fred, and this is his wife, Elizabeth. And he showed me these tools. And I said, well, who are you for? He said, I'm for that guy over there. It's a new guy called Dave. I said, what's the message? He said, he's lost something. Tell him that he keeps on looking to find it. So I go to Dave and said, describe this. He said, okay. Dave didn't look very enthusiastic. And I thought, that's a really crappy message. So at the end of the circle, I went up to Dave. I said, what do you make of the message? He said, oh, that's okay. He said, I said, well, who is that? He said, well, it's my grandfather, Fred. That was my grandmother, Elizabeth. I said, what are the tools? He said, well, he was a bookbinder. There were the tools he used. He was a bookbinder. He used to put gold leaf on the leather. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, well, you lost it. He said, I lost the keys to the factory. I'm confident. I said, what do you mean? He said, yeah, that's what you do, isn't it? Now, he the first time he'd ever been in a spiritual church, he said, that's what we did. That was amazing. He obviously thought, oh, that, yeah, it's just what spirits do. So, again, oops, I'm wrong. So, proof. How did it, what's the proof that the curse is real? So, what has DC World in Enfield and the lovely, actually, they have only got to do with the curse of Warrior from 19th century Africa? What I'm telling you. So, anybody go to DC World? It's very cool. Yeah, there's only one person to check out. It's a queue for hours. So I need to get a new inkjet print for my cartridge. And I've got to be in surgery 5 minutes. And I know that I'm going to be queuing for hours. And Coza's in the back of my car saying, go into PC World and get yourself an inkjet printer. And there's no way I'm going to get an inkjet printer this much. I'll be there for hours. She said, no, trust me, go in there. So I go in there. And there's one woman about checkout. She's my patient, Anna. And the inkjet printer at the car show me, she's right by a checkout. I said, Pam, I need that. She said, sure, Doc, I'll give it to you 20% staff discount. I mean, in like 2 minutes. And I hear him chuckling in the back seat. I still don't buy it. VHS, this is a VHS cartridge. So this is sat on top of our VHS recorder for months. I've recorded a film long before I got into spiritualism. It sat there. And it was Lara Croft and the Cradle of Life. In fact, my son Paul recorded it. He hadn't watched it. Everyone had gone to bed. I thought I'd watch it. And I was thinking about Coza. I mean, really, this is, you know, to be a doctor and interacting with spirit guides and voices in your head is really, you know, really, really trying myself to be not so this. And so I thought about it. Forget this. Let's watch the film. So I'm watching the film, quite like Angelina Jolie. The film's got the kids still, and halfway through I got a bit bored, and I started to sort of think about Coza. All of a sudden, on the film, Angelina Jolie and Lara Croft picks up the phone and says, tell Coza to meet me north of the village, north of this village, we're off to Kilimanjaro. I thought, what? Pause, freeze, rewind. I'm going schizophrenic. I'm getting messages through my TV. No. Tell Coza to leave north of the village, not to Kilimanjaro. It really got my attention. So the next part of the film is Lara Croft going across the plains of Kilimanjaro with an eye, Coza, fighting off evil spirits, no less. How does that work? So the next night I went into my circle and said, so look, how does this work? How could that happen? Call that broken spiritualism. The things would have to come together. Angelina Jolie would have to get the part, someone would have to write the script, Paul would have to record it, then I'd have to watch it at the very moment just to prove that he's real. How does that work? And they said, then the group was, well, that's what they can do. So that's what the 19th century Coza and Warrior has to do with DC World and Enfield, and then they'll be Angelina Jolie. I don't really understand that. But I think I take that as proof there's something up. Though, how that works in reality, I don't know. So, that's more or less how I got into it. Everything was fine whilst it was in a circle. And I thought I could keep it there. Unfortunately, or fortunately, it started to bleed through into my professional life. So the first time it happened was the end of the circle. One of the meetings, Mary was again, she came up and she said, "Who's that German officer in Second World War uniform? He's tall, thin, blonde-haired guy, very impatient, something he's talking about here." She recently was. I said, "Well, look, bearing in mind that I'm Jewish and half my family perished in concentration camps, I hardly think I had a German officer attached to me." But she said, "Well, he's coming to live here." So I thought about it. I said, "Well, my cousin Lottie, she was on the kidney transport, but I couldn't place him." Then I suddenly remembered I had this patient called Ellie Richardson. Ellie was German. She'd been in the bombing of Hamburg. She'd actually, at the end of the war, married a family who was in the British occupying forces in Germany. And she'd come over and settled in the UK. And I knew Ellie very well. I looked after Tony with his final illness. And Ellie had now developed respiratory problems. I used to see her very often, lovely lady. And I wondered if it was for her. But it was like the cold winter's night, and I wasn't going to go around and knock on the door at 9 o'clock and say, "By the way, Ellie, I've got this German spirit for you. Can you take it?" But funnily enough, she was down by 8:30 o'clock the next day. And I looked at her name on the screen and said, "I wish I knew what this guy's name was." And I heard in my head, "Heinz." And so she came into my room. I didn't know what to say. So I said, "Ellie, I met a medium last night. She gave me a funny mission." She told me, "I'm into mediums." She said, "Since Tally died, you seem amazing. I'm 21. She gives me lovely messages." I said, "Oh, all right. Well, I wondered if you could take this gentleman. I said, dysfunctional, that sounds like my boyfriend, Karl Heinz. He was in a Panzer regiment in the war. He was killed. We never heard of him again." I thought, I wish I'd mentioned the name Karl Heinz, but I didn't. Well, that wasn't really me giving the message. That was second hand. The first time I ever gave a proper message was with Gordon. So Janet came into my room, and as she did, I saw her father-in-law. I looked after Gordon, who died of cancer, and I actually saw a picture of him in my head, wearing a hat with antlers on. And I knew that I had to give it to Janet. I didn't know how to say it. So I said to Janet, I'll make up a story. I said, "Janet, every time I think of Gordon, I imagine you sitting on a wooden bench in a medieval hall under some antlers." And she said, "Oh, you've seen the photo, have you?" I said, "What photo?" "Didn't he show you the photo? It's really proud of it." Of course, I said, "What's this?" He was an extra in a film. And he had to wear a hat with antlers on it and carry a shotgun. It was a comedy film. And actually, I hadn't seen it. He'd be far too ill to be showing off. But I said, "No, I hadn't seen it." She gave me a knowing look, but I didn't actually say anything. The very first proper message I gave directly to someone was to Pat. And so I looked after Tony, her husband. And he died. And as Pat came in, Tony was in the doorway and he had these blankets under his arm. He was going like that, pointing to them. And now Pat was a spiritual, said, "Look, Pat, we've got Tony here." And he's pointing to these blankets. And she said, "Ah, yes." She said, "These are the blankets which I knitted. We're going to give him to the hospital when he died. He's reminded me." And with that, a lot more information coming through. He showed me about the when they're courting days in the west end of London, the shops they used to go to, and the war cemetery they used to go to. She had a very comforting. This is stunning. This is Lucy. Lucy does not mind me using her real name. In fact, she wants me to tell people the story. So Lucy is lovely. This happened on the 6th of December 2004, that's very important. Lucy is a bright, bubbly lady. She came to my room, she was in tears, floods of tears, she couldn't stop crying. After 15 minutes, I couldn't work out why she was depressed, and she was saying, "Doctor, you've got to help me, I'm so depressed. I don't know why, you really didn't help me." And with that, I thought, well, I'll prescribe an antidepressant. So I sort of typed in, pulled out a prescription for some citalopram, which is one of the antidepressants. As I took out the printer, I felt the blows around my head. Heard a voice saying, "Ask about my father." With that, I saw the ghostly outline of a man over her left shoulder. And I said, "Lucy, tell me about your dad." She stopped crying and said, "He was killed 38 years ago on the 8th of December by the IRA. Do you think that's why I'm depressed? I met him in 2 days' time anniversary." And I said, "Lucy, did he look like?" He described the man over her shoulder. She said, "Yes, how do you know?" I said, "Oh, I think I can see over your left shoulder." With that, she grabbed my arm, said, Doctor, thank you so much for telling us. Do you know what this means to me? So she said he was killed by, she thinks, by the IRA. She was in service in Manchester at this time, and she was 16. She was on the boat back to Ireland, but it was too late. And he'd been speaking out against the IRA, even though he was Catholic, and they found his half feathered in a drain. She'd always felt that her dad was around her, but whenever she mentioned to her sister, they said, well, we're Catholic, we're not to believe that. Now, I said this to her, and it validated the things. Not only that, once she said, well, now I know why I'm depressed, because I don't need your city tablet. Thank you, God. She didn't have my room. And then told my receptionist, Carol, what I said to her. And I thought that was it. That was it. My career was now over. I really thought my career was over. That was it. It was out. The cat was out the back. That was it. You know, clap me eyes. 4 weeks later, she comes back into my surgery. All smiles. What's wrong with her? Nothing. And why are you here then? She perhaps said, I can't tell you a story. So she sits down with a smile on her face. She said, 2 weeks after I saw you, doctor, I was at my Irish social club. There's a creepy geese who's got the second sight, not a very nice man, who's tapping my coat, and I said, Lucy, 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 I've got a message for you. Come into this room, I'll give you this message. She's unpacking it wrong with you. You want to give me a message, you can get me here in the hall. She said, do you know there's a man on your left shoulder? I think he's your father. She said, of course I do. My doctor told me that 2 weeks ago. She said, you know what, that sure took the wind out of his sails. He saved the NHS prescription. Jade. So Jade's mother, Leslie, wasn't my patient actually, but Leslie was dying of breast cancer. And Jade knew I was, by this time, I'd gone around with Dr. Rubenstein, also known as Dr. Frankenstein, was talking to the spirit world. And she wondered if I, and her mother had actually felt the presence on her bed. And actually, Jade wanted me to go around and see who was coming to visit her, because Jade thought her mum was going to die, she thought no one was going to visit her. So I went down there and just spoke to Leslie. And I actually got the impression that it was her deceased cousin. And I told her a few of my stories. Eventually, Leslie died, and Jade came to me and she said, what are you picking up, Doc? So I said, okay, I'll see what you got. And I said, well, your mum's showing me her last fairy collection. She said, no. Sorry, Doc. Jade's great. She's a very good recipient. She said, no, I can't take it. Sorry. 3 months later, she came to see me. They moved a cabinet in the house. They're clearing out mum's house. And they found a box behind the cabinet full of last fairies. Now, no one had known that, not even Jade. So I couldn't have read that from mine. Fate and fortune. So, Brian, Beckinsale. Remember Beckinsale, Richard Beckinsale from Porridge? Mm-hmm. So Brian Beckinsale was a distant relative of Richard Beckinsale. Lovely guy, big guy, lovely guy. Full of great presence. He has had a little operation this time. The blood test result can come back. There's a little operation. He actually had leukemia in 1 year. And he had no platelets, so he reached your clotting factor in blood. So he bled to death with no platelets. But a little operation. It was devastating. Lizzie came into my room. Devastating. I was devastated. I didn't know this happened. But suddenly, Brian's there. Well, I couldn't see him, but he was like, he was a big guy. He was there. Where my father came from, Lizzie was there. He was there. And he was like, hello, Doc. I'm back. He's all right, don't worry, mate. Come on. And he's saying, look, tell her, I started giving you a message. Tell her to sort the pond out. He described this little white plastic float. He said, the Garden Pond needs sorting out. Tell her to get a move on with the shed. And I was like relaying the message, and Linda saying, yeah, all right, yeah. She's writing it down. He's giving me a shot. This happened for a year. A year. Now, I mean, she said it was real. I said, she may have just been grateful for me to give a message. They're called message grabs, you can grab anything. But two things happened that made me think this is really weird. Brian's there, I mean, so I can see him, I hear him, and he's saying, tell her about the sticks. So I said, Linda, Brian wants me to tell her about the sticks. She goes, whoa! I know what he means. I said, what sticks? She starts showing my shopping. She takes out her shopping list, and the top is garden canes. She said, I've just got some garden canes from Tesco across the road. Good. And there was the proof, she crossed it through. And the other time I was giving some acupuncture for a back trouble. And then Brian's saying, tell her that I know about the Scottish relatives. So I said, Linda, can I watch this show about Scottish relatives? And she laughed. She said, yeah, on Saturday, two relatives from Scotland turned up unannounced. So, that's right. She was so impressed with the message, as well as the whole family. So she said, look, can I write to them? Can I read a fake fortune record? She said, can I write to them? So I said, yeah, what? And they did a nice spread about that. So that's how we got the fake fortune magazine. This is Paul. Paul died of lung cancer. He's a heavy smoker. This is my sister. Sue came to see me. And I was aware of Paul, who shamed me, he's in a boat, rowing. Now I've got me a Cornwall. And she said, yeah, that's exactly what Paul would like to do. And started giving me messages that she could take. And then she said, Paul's son Daniel would like to hear from me. Can he come? Daniel got my patient. So I said, sure. This is Daniel, this is my father. So Daniel came along and Paul started showing me this. I said, Daniel, I can see these like these little airport security type trays, but they're all some sort of conveyor belt. And they're whizzing through this massive conveyor belt. It's huge, and this is a conveyor belt. And he laughed, he said, yeah. I said, where'd you, is this where you went? Yeah. Where'd you go to work at a cargo fulfillment centre in Hampton? It's the largest conveyor belt in Europe, actually. And he said, the funny thing was, is he'd always told Paul about this, but of course he couldn't show him. He said, now, Dad's showing me that he knows, he's been there in spirit. So I actually became Facebook friends through that, and they messaged me. That's the message that Dan has said. I mean, really helped him. He was cracking up. And that's what Arda said. So this stuff is really incredibly healing and therapeutic. So, that's pretty much all I've got to say to you. The end of the last card of the Arcana, the world. And we start with the fall. And the world is the end of sight and life, and showing what we've learned. And I've hopefully shared it with you. And some of you already bought it, but my book's at the back if you want to read a lot more that happened. All proceeds go to cancer charities from the book. Don't get any of myself. That more or less is it. And I'm still struggling with this, by the way. Doesn't come easy, but that's my story. I hope you enjoy it.
We have time for questions. So,
we have a lady here.
Ever get help with your diagnosis on patients in spirit?
Interesting enough. No. When it started happening, I started going to visit healing sanctuaries and things. I thought I was going to become a doctor because you think you're going for healing. But actually, no, I was a bit steered right away from it. And I think it's because that would muddy the waters. I think had I gone into that, then you're in quite difficult ground with the General Medical Council. I mean, it's difficult enough giving messages, but that's music therapeutically. So therapeutically, bereavement counseling, absolutely. I will go on the record, and the BMA, there's a woman called Sarah Jarvis, and she goes on about, doctors should not be in spirituality. I firmly believe that we should be in our patient's spirituality. I mean, not sort of preaching or anything, but you need to deal with the spiritual aspects of your patient's lives. And I think that this is very, very useful in breathing counselling. And I'm not the only one. There's a guy called Piero Calvi-Parisetti. He's a Scottish doctor. Now, he's not a medium, but he's looked at the evidence of life after death. And he's convinced, from a scientific perspective. And he's written a book called Life Knows About Death. He's worked with the Frederick Family Foundation. It's a workbook for bereavement, which you then go through looking at the evidence. And in fact, bearing in mind, I'm still sceptical. I don't quite believe this story myself. I worked through it as well, because there's a bit of me which is like, this can't be real. And I worked through Piero's workbook just to convince myself that the research is there, because it is there. So The only time was once I was examining and giving acupuncture to this lady, and as I looked at her back, I saw this huge salmon on her back. And I said to her, I mean, I was at the space event, so I was giving her some advice, and I said, I can see this salmon on the back. Why am I seeing this? And she went bright red. She said, I'm a vegan, but last month I had salmon for absolutely. So that, yeah, but not the diagnosis. And not feeling, actually, I have patients who come give me here. I've got a guy called George, who said, he's an ex-Barts hospital painter. He says, and he's 90 now, and he comes, he waits outside my door, without an appointment. And he's a very gentle man. He says, the boss sent me, he wants me to give you some healing. He comes into my surgery, he says, he puts his hands on me and gives me healing. I've got some lovely patients. I mean, they really respond. I thought that every thought by Western scientifically trained people, right? I thought every thought in terms of logic. I realised that people don't. It's a minority. My patients don't think like that. No wonder they don't understand what the hell doctors are saying. They don't think like doctors or folk. So I've crossed over. I've actually gone native. I mean, I can deal with both. I now see myself as someone who's traveled two worlds. It's been a real eye-opener for me. I want to give this back into medicine. I'm still struggling with how one does that. But I actually think that's happening for me because I got the fellowship in 2014. I was well into this then, and my book had been published. And when I got the fellowship from the Royal College of GPs, as I left, I mean, I was the only one ever to get this, as I left this posh top floor at Euston, I said to Sarah, gushing me like this wall, people, I said, do they know that I see dead people? She said, yes, they do, they're very interested. So I ended up working at quite a high level, meeting doctors who are like professors and scientists, and they come to me and say, Ian, you've written this book about mediumship. And they're all interested, but they won't talk, they can't tell everybody that they're interested. They can't tell I will just tell it as it is. What do they do? I'm 63 now, I'm one half time. I wasn't then, it's quite brave of me, I was 47, but now, sod it, yeah. No, I'm not that brave. I'm prepared to go on the record. I think someone's got to. I think I've been given such weird experiences that if there's any truth to it, it's because I'm prepared to sort of talk about it. Otherwise, it's a waste. Any other questions?
Questions?
Come on. Sir?
You talked about your training to become a medium.
Yes.
And presumably, I probably only a year or two on it, but there was concentration, there was relaxation, and there were various other approaches that you had to go through. So when you actually had your own experiences later, do you think that you wouldn't have had those had you not undergone medium?
I think I had to go through that. I think if we accept this as real, whatever real is, I don't know what reality is, then let's assume that I was placed on this path, or could have been chosen this path, higher level, I don't know. Then I think I had to go through it. Absolutely, because I learned an awful lot. Do I think I'm special? No. I think I'm just in a special position by being a doctor. I think we can all do this. I'm not a very good medium. I'm sure that mediums are much better than me. My unique selling point is the position I'm in. We can all, everybody can kick football, not really can kick the football like David Beckham, but there's mediums like Gordon Smith, the David Beckham of mediumship. If only I could be like that, he's wonderful. But I obviously had something there for me off because I had these experiences before. Certainly when Felicity's face changed, looking back at it, Maurice Gross, who did the M4 poltergeist investigation, you know, this guy with Anne Barnes, that guy did the. No, it was a BBC programme recently. I went to his house and this is the tape recordings of the M4 poltergeist. I told him what I'd witnessed. And I hadn't told him I was trained as a medium. And he said to me, I think you and your sister are in the mediums. When he said that, I said, Maurice, I am trained as a medium. I think the energy was there. I think obviously. Can I tell you a little bit of another story? Before I used to tell this story, I used to tell the story about the day I almost died. I now put this in my book because at the time I didn't realise the significance. When I was 9, I had my tonsils out. And I bled from the tonsils of the bed. And I lost a lot of blood. And I had to take it back down to the theatre. And I was really quite ill. I didn't need a blood transfusion. I couldn't be at death's door. But I was very unwell. I remember going under the anaesthetic. I had an experience, which is now called an experience. And I felt the same being extruded from my sense of being. It was like topping on one glass. And it was winding down this black, like a garden polytunnel. It was black. And there was a little light on the end of the stalk. And I knew that actually I was that little light on the end of that stalk. And I just told that story. Not because I told these stories. When these stories came out, I thought, tell it. It's only subsequently I realised that in the near-death experience, a lot of people who have NDEs, they're called, often they come back with enhanced psychic awareness. So maybe it was that, I don't know. By the way, I didn't see a being of light, but I always remember being the age of 9 thinking, I'm that little star on the end of that stalk. Yeah, and then I lost consciousness. That's not in my book. I just realised that. And the other thing, which isn't in my book, the date is quite important. This big family problem involved with me being disinherited, right? And I was actually disinherited from my parents. The will had been signed, I didn't know this until a couple of years ago, the will had been signed the 2nd of July 2003. Keith came to see me on the 4th of July 2003. So it's only when you go, as more information comes out, you realise that there are reasons for this. So I've come to the conclusion that actually, this is a weak plan, somehow. Which means that life's a good job. Time isn't what we think. We aren't who we think we are. And if time isn't what we think, then space isn't what we think. Look, we don't know where we are, who we are, or when we are. We don't know who we are, or consciousness, we don't know the nature of time and space. A lot of patients don't know who they are, where they are, when they are. I say they're demented. So we're all demented. We're all confused, which is a good place to be, I think. I think it's the only honest place to be.
Do most of your patients know that this is what you do in your other life?
Well, bearing in mind, I've got that on my wall.
Right.
Okay. So sometimes they'll come in and they'll say, oh, I've had this experience and you think I'm mad. And I'll say, because they have to sit here, and there's a medical poster up, not a big problem. And I'll say, stand up. Yeah. I'll say, turn around, look at the wall. And I go, what? Oh! You're in the wall, yes. I said, yeah, I know what you're going through. I can't do that. So there's still a few duns. But yeah, pretty much it's now got out. My colleagues know. Yeah, a lot of people know. That was on Channel 4 as well. That was funny. So, I used to solve Felicity's face all the time. My wife was heartily sick of it. Heartily sick of it. She would say, I'm not going to hear this again. Then I saw it on Channel 4. Then I wrote it in my book. Then it was on Coast to Coast. She said, you've told this whole bloody world. But it's one thing, I always get to say this, you know the lips would distort at the bottom. Well, Keith Hudson is an antiquarian book collector. He collected old books from spiritualism. And the old books talk about the build-up of ectoplasm. And as I was reading them, one of the things they noticed was that the body, the forms build up often from the floor upwards. So that the top half of the figure is perfectly formed first, and the bottom isn't. She's only what I saw. But the lips hadn't formed properly. That's what scared the Jesus out of my sister. These lips hadn't formed properly. Now, how could I have known that? Now, it hadn't. It was an incident. This, I mean, this is, if you're a medium, you've been to transfiguration services, yeah. Some mediums, they'll go up and back them and they'll do transfiguration. And they say, oh, yeah, you can be Chinese, I can see a really new feather. What I saw was in your face. It was unbelievable. There's no mistake. It wasn't like a little bit. This was in your face. Piercing blue eyes looking at me. Never forget that.
The lady at the front.
Yes.
I was really moved by what you were saying about living in Tottenham, and because that's where I grew up.
Which road?
Paddington.
Oh, right. Oh, it's Andrew.
Yeah. And I did the experience. experiments with the Ouija board as well. And I got a message that said it was from my father who died a couple of years before. And he said that I had to tell the family that Vicky, which was one of his brothers, was going to die of lung cancer before Christmas. And this was about September time. And very shortly after that, I had a message from my mother saying, oh, Uncle Albert's been diagnosed with lung cancer. And he did die before Christmas.
These little messages, aren't they? I mean, I'm not sure I'd want to give those out to people. I certainly wouldn't, but...
It was the wrong brother. But it was Uncle Vicky that rang my mother and told her about Uncle Albert. And I always wondered, you know, why did I get that message wrong?
I could wax for hours. I could bore you about the technicality. I mean, this is where I get more scientific. We're talking about this broadband and this narrowband, right? We're dealing with narrowband communication here, right? Do you remember the old days? They were called spirit guided controls, and they called the medium the instrument. Think of a player piano. You know the old piano, right? The notes are in the piano, and you've got a very simple scroll with punch holes in it, okay? The piano can only play the notes in it. If we update that to current technology, it has a MIDI file, which is a text file, very simple file, which you then send to a piano that plays, or a clarinet that plays, whatever it is, or a guitar. Very simple. Narrowband communication, notes have to be in the piano. If you've got an MP3 file, there's no notes in it, the notes are in the file. You can play it on something that hasn't got notes in it. One requires broadband, one requires narrowband. Unfortunately, we're narrowband. Occasionally it's broadband, it's always narrowband. So it depends on you. So basically, they can only use what's in your mind. And if that's a bit unclear, the message can get scrambled. So, and there's other technicalities as well, conditions, things going all over the place. That's how I see it.
I was quite freaked out.
Yeah, I'd be freaked out. I've had one message like that, which is like, was a lady, she always didn't get kissed when I saw her, and I knew I was going to see her the next day, and I knew she had a cold sore. And I didn't want to get a cold, sore from her kiss. And I was lying there thinking, oh God, she's going to get a kiss, give me a cold sore, what should I do? And I heard a voice saying, she won't come soon, she's going to die. And she did. That's the only time I've heard that. I didn't say it to anybody. I don't really want to hear that sort of thing. The messages I get are, on the whole, comforting. I got one complaint. Saw that complaint I got? Saw a lady. I saw a knee. Comes into my room, I examine the knee, I give the appropriate treatment for her, she goes out, she then makes a complaint. Practice manager. Complaint was, I saw her at the room this time. They treated my knee, My father-in-law died 2 weeks ago. He gave me a message from my father-in-law. I was thinking that. I was lying awake at night, worrying about it. The shoes were made, but I hadn't given a message.
Nothing to do with that. We have a different question. Mediumship spirits making contact with those who passed over. A lot of people think that energies out there are changing at the moment.
We are
going for something called ascension and so on. How does that tie
in
with that?
Every time he comes and turns me up, I'm still in contact. And he gives these long rambling. He's a lovely guy, he's very psychic, but he deals with more than one sort of spirit. We get these long phone calls. How's it going, Pete? Whoa, it's chaos on the astral planes. It's absolute chaos here. It's all mixed up. That's what he says. Who am I? I don't know, maybe you're right. There's all sorts of weird stuff there. As we know, everything's in change. I don't know. Ascension? I don't know. There's always end times. I don't know. I think this is a school. I think we come here and we pass on. People, and it's like saying, I think nothing really changes. I mean, you say outside my kids' old primary school, and you look at these things, these silly humans, what are they just fighting to squabble? 100 years later, silly humans, they're just fighting and squabbling. They're still doing it. But they have to grow up and move on. Hopefully we grow up and move on. I think you need schools like this. I think, you know, 100 years' time would be quite similar. It'll be different times. We'll be back in Europe, I don't know.
But do you think it will be the same here?
I hope not. I mean, I hope the aliens find a guilt as well. Because the thing I'm more into in this is UFOs. My first love is UFOs and aliens. I have to mention aliens. Josh is smiling. My son's about to be smiling. I have to mention, Rupert's and I's first door of paranormal, it always ends with aliens. Yeah. Yes, doesn't it? Whichever door you go through, you always end up dealing with aliens, remember. Any other questions? Because I can go on for that. Oh, yes.
I've just got one in. Thanks for the talk. It's a bit of a technical question. Most of the examples that you gave were, I suppose, English-speaking people, and you described your practice as being very multi-ethnic.
Yeah.
What happens when you're speaking to someone for whom English is not the first language, and perhaps the person that's passed their language, certainly not English? Yeah. At what level does that communication
take? I want to say the message using a Romanian word. I can't remember what the funny word is. In fact, we have a Romanian speaker at the back there, Josh's girlfriend, Bianca, she actually speaks Romanian. Have a Romanian patient, Mihaela, and I was transported to a mountainous rural scene, and I described this lady, and it was her grandmother. And her grandmother used a word that I can't remember, I don't remember what the word was, and Mihaela said, that's the Romanian word, I know what it means. It's the only time I've ever done it. It's difficult because I'm not the most widely travelled people, and as they can only use what's in my head, it's a little bit difficult for me.
So is the communication sort of transcending English? Are you communicating in another way? Or?
Oh yeah, it's not. That's I tend to see rather than hear.
Right.
I've actually heard a voice on two occasions, with the keys and with Lucy. Mostly it's gut feeling and seeing. Or just knowing something.
Thanks.
There must be occasions as a doctor when you see patients that have suffered as a result of violence or abuse or things like that.
Yes.
Do you get sort of messages for them, or and what happens, say, if somebody who's been a murderer passes over and then contact your family or something? Do you have any sort of bearing on that?
I have no experience of that. The stuff I get has been quite mundane. Although I have got a theory about people who are in domestic abuse. A lot of people who've been abused or come from abusive childhoods often end up being psychic. Did anyone notice that? I think that's something I've noticed, or have had. I don't know if I've been abused, but looking back, I realise I came from quite an old family. And I think, my theory is that, that often these people are like milk cows for energy. They get their auras punched, holes in the aura, metaphorically, so they can feed off their energy. And these holes, they use to feed other people, looking for people who are giving people. But as I say, the holes which you punched in also let the light in. So I think that's often how I describe that. But no, I never want to have it's all very mundane. Yes?
I'm really intrigued by what Mike needs or could share with us in a nutshell about aliens.
Aliens?
Your feelings on them, and also, but particularly, is it in any way linked and connected with what's happening to you anyway?
Well, anybody who doesn't believe that they... If you look at the UFO, I'm sorry. I mean, it's UFO since I was a kid. If you look at the evidence, Enrico Fermi, the Fermi paradox, in the 1950s, a physicist, Nobel Prize, he said, where are they then? What do you mean? So there's all these suns here. And they should be here by now, because you can colonize the galaxy, even at sunlight speeds, in about a million years, and galaxies, billions of years, or where are they? Well, they're obviously here. It's probably us. I mean, they're just hiding, obviously. But, I think there's enough evidence. I mean, you've got case after case, Travis Wharton, Calvin Parkin, and Pascal Goodman, and all this. I think there's so much evidence. And also, anybody at Glastonbury heard of Nick Carles, former president of the Scottish Society of Psychical Research, in the Skull Group. And in the Skull Circle, it's the physical mediumship circle in Norfolk, they have the most amazing stuff. And they were dealing with trans-dimensional, hyper-dimensional alien entities that were coming through, little mini flying saucer appeared. I've got a lot of time for Nick Carles. He's a solid guy, he's a former deputy head. He and his wife, Sarah, was deputy heads of comprehensive schools in Scotland. They are solid people. When I went out for a meal with them, and they described to me what they saw, they had spirit lights whizzing through them, things dematerializing, mini flying saucers coming through. I mean, I just think this, we have to accept the fact that whatever they are, they're there. Yeah. The way I sometimes wonder if, in fact, we're a bit like this Caterpillar and life cycle. So imagine if you're a butterfly, we're caterpillars on a leaf, then we change, become butterflies, and so we go from leaf running insects to aerial running creatures. So we think of a separate distance. There may well be other beings that can hop from air to the leaf very easily, like birds. So what do you call the afterlife, or this life? There may be beings that live quite comfortably within the two, which is just that difference in perspective. No, I like it.
Well, listen, I think we'll draw to a close there. That was absolutely brilliant, and I'm sure you'd all like to join me in thanking you. Thank you.
Where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.